The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro. Part 2, continued on cassette number 5, side 1. He could, of course, have gone to parties, but his belief that he could not make small talk, his fear that he would make a fool of himself if he tried, made parties an ordeal. He talked for years about the first Washington cocktail party he had gone to, back when he was a freshman congressman. I never felt that the hostess knew or cared whether I was there or not, so I stopped going to parties. He tried to prolong the hours he spent on Capitol Hill. Jack Garner's old Board of Education had been disbanded, but a few congressional leaders still gathered for a drink at the end of the day, and Rayburn was always there. But the others would leave rather quickly. They had wives and families and social engagements to go to. Rayburn tried never to let them see that he did not. He never asked them to stay, often made a point of leaving early himself, as if he too had somewhere else to go. The tough time was the weekends, when everyone went home to his wife, says D.B. Hardiman, who was to become his aide during the 1950s. During those later years, Rayburn's position as speaker provided him with a staff, and on weekends he would telephone its members, aides like Hardiman and John Holton, House Doorkeeper Miller, or Sergeant-at-Arms Harding. He would sound very jovial on the phone, asking them to go fishing with him in some lakes down near the Maryland shore, or to come over for Sunday breakfast and read the Sunday papers with him. Asking was very hard for Sam Rayburn, however, and although the aides would accept his invitations, "Sometimes I had something planned, but I would come because I knew he had nothing to do," one says. He did not ask often. The pride which made it so hard for him to issue an invitation made it hard for him even to accept one. His aides would, of course, invite him to their homes, but he could not accept too often. He didn't want anyone to get the idea that he didn't have anything to do. His aides knew the truth, however. Rayburn would sometimes instruct Hardiman or Holton to come to the office on a Sunday, on the pretext that there was work to do, but often there wasn't. The young men would watch him opening all the drawers of his desk and taking out every paper, looking for something to do. Says Ken Harding, "He had many worshippers, but very few close friends. You held him in awe. You didn't dare get close to him. People feared to get close to him because they were afraid of saying the wrong thing. And because people were afraid to get close to him, he was a very lonely guy. His life was a tragedy. I felt very, very sorry for Sam Rayburn." During the 1930s, he did not yet have a staff that he could telephone. For a while, he made an effort to round up weekend fishing parties from among the Texas congressmen, driving down to the Maryland lakes on Saturday and sleeping over in cabins Saturday night. "Those who went along for the first time were stunned by the change in Rayburn's personality," a friend writes. Solemn, laconic, and brief in the Capitol, on the road he was talkative, humorous, and a great tease. But how many times could he ask people to come? And if he was turned down once by someone, no matter how legitimate the excuse, how graciously it was made, how could Sam Rayburn ask again? So if he went to the Maryland Lakes, he usually went alone. In a letter to a friend in Texas, these words burst out of him. "God, what I would give for a tow-headed boy to take fishing." And often during the 30s, he would spend his weekends in Washington, taking long walks, a lonely figure wandering for hours through the deserted streets, his face set grimly as if he wanted to be alone, as if daring anyone to talk to him. When Lyndon Johnson had first come to Washington in December 1931, he had made a determined effort to become friendly with Sam Rayburn. The entree had been good, as it was with everyone who knew Lyndon's father. "Dear Sam," Rayburn was to write, "you are one member with whom I served in the legislature, whom I remember with pleasure." And Rayburn took a liking to the gangling young man, but his cordiality was limited by custom. A congressional secretary could visit a congressman in his office only on the rare occasions when he had an excuse, a business reason, to be there. Sometimes, in the late afternoon, Clayburgh and Roy Miller would go to Rayburn's office or to Garner's, where Rayburn would be present. Watching them walk out, Johnson would tell Latimer or Jones, "Well, they're going to have some bourbon and branch water. He wanted to go, but he was never asked. And he had no excuse to see Rayburn outside the office. After Lyndon and Ladybird took their little Kalorama Road apartment in December 1934, however, Lyndon could invite Mr. Sam, as he called him, to dinner. When he came, Ladybird recalls, nothing was too good for him. This was, of course, the rule at many homes to which he was often invited, but to which he came infrequently, or, more probably, only once. At this apartment, however, although the hostess's smile never wavered, there was not only nervousness behind it, but fear. Ladybird was very much afraid, at first, of this fierce-looking man. And Sam Rayburn saw behind the smile, and made an effort for this shy, timid young woman, so small and slim that she looked like a little girl. How great an effort can be measured by the number of more sophisticated Washington hostesses for whom he would not make it, to put her at ease. When he saw, she never told him, how homesick she was, he tried to cheer her up by talking about Texas and about his boyhood on the farm. He told her his favorite foods. He liked to eat the things he had had at home as a boy, black-eyed peas, cornbread, peach ice cream, good chili, she recalls. And when he came to dinner thereafter, she cooked them for him, and, she says, as he came more and more frequently, learned to make them the way he liked them. And her sweetness and graciousness put him, this man who was seldom at ease without a gavel in his hand, at ease. He began to accept the Johnsons' invitations not only to dinner but to breakfast, to Sunday breakfast, breakfast on the weekends when he had nothing to do. After breakfast, Ladybird would suggest that Lyndon and Mr. Sam read the Sunday papers together while she cleaned up, and he began staying longer and longer. Lyndon Johnson was provided with ample opportunity to exercise the talents that had led people to call him a professional son on this man who so desperately wanted a son. Other congressional secretaries found one Johnson gesture particularly unbelievable, although it would have been quite believable to San Marcos students who had seen Johnson pat feared Prexy Evans on the back. When, in the halls of Congress, Johnson met Sam Rayburn, he would bend over and kiss him on his bald head. So strong was the wall that Sam Rayburn had built around himself that it was not easy even for Lyndon Johnson to break it down. But he broke it down. Although the Johnson living room contained a sofa and an easy chair, Mr. Sam always sat instead in a straight-backed kitchen chair, as if afraid to relax. But more and more often now he would lean forward and put his hands on his knees and tell stories. He was a great storyteller, Lady Bird recalls. He remembered Woodrow Wilson and all these other figures. He began to invite Lyndon and Lady Bird to his apartment for breakfast. And sometime in the late spring of 1935, the exact date cannot be determined, but it was while Ladybird, homesick, had returned to Karnak for a visit in May and June of that year, Lyndon Johnson developed pneumonia and was taken to a hospital. And when he awoke, sitting beside his bed was Sam Rayburn, his usually expressionless face twisted with anxiety. He was so agitated that he had forgotten he was smoking, and his vest was littered with cigarette ashes. "Now, Lyndon," he said, "don't you worry. Take it easy. If you need money or anything, just call on me." Gifted though he was at arousing paternal feelings, not only Rayburn's, but those of Roy Miller and Rash Adams and Alvin Wirtz, he had been unable to translate affection into advancement. On the very day in 1931 on which he had been appointed to his new job, he had begun planning to leave it. To Ella Sorella's congratulations on that day, he had replied that the post of congressional secretary was only a stepping stone, only the bottom rung on the political ladder he was so anxious to climb. Now, however, it was 1935, and he was still on the same rung. For almost 4 years he had been tirelessly ingratiating himself with congressmen, agreeing with their views, dancing with their wives, always campaigning. And where had the campaigning gotten him? Long aware of what the next rung should be, it had been years now since, hearing about a congressional secretary who had succeeded to his boss's seat, he had said, "That's the route to follow." He had attempted to set out upon that route the moment he was eligible, subtly attempting, as his 25th birthday approached, to turn Congressman Clayburgh into Ambassador Clayburgh. Now the birthday approaching was his 27th, and the route was still blocked. Blocked, since no one could beat a Clayburgh in Clayburgh country, by an immovable object that was giving no signs of moving of its own accord. Dick Clayburgh's lack of interest in his job had led Johnson to hope that he would tire of being a congressman. To his dismay, however, he saw that while Clayburgh remained bored by Washington politics, he had discovered the attractive possibilities of Washington social life. With a sinking heart, Johnson was coming to realize that his boss had no intention of leaving his job. A South American ambassadorship might still have changed his mind, of course, but an ambassadorship was no longer a realistic possibility for a man whose hostility to the Bolshevik in the White House had become obvious. If there was a longer route to a higher peak than a congressional seat, a route that only he saw, he had tried to start along that route, too, had worked for the most radical as well as the most reactionary congressman, had trimmed his sail to every wind, had done favors and created an acquaintance not just in his district but throughout Texas. But acquaintance had thus far borne no more fruit than had affection. He was no closer to achieving his great ambition in 1935 than he had been in 1931. During his first months in Washington, Estelle Harbin had seen that he couldn't stand not being somebody, just could not stand it. "I'm not the assistant type," he had said. But the little daily humiliations, having to step back when his congressman stepped into the members-only elevator, having to wait outside the congressional cloakrooms because he was not allowed inside, reminded him daily that for almost 4 years an assistant was what he was, that he was not a somebody, but a nobody, just one of the crowd of low-paid, powerless congressional secretaries. Other developments, too, were making Johnson's life in Washington less pleasant than it had been. Among his contemporaries, at least, he had been somebody, the boss of the little Congress. But in 1935 that changed, too. The whispers about the way in which Lyndon Johnson had won the organization's speakership had not died away, because with each succeeding election, invariably won by the candidate of the boss of the little Congress, they started up again. The belief that elections were being, in the word of his fellow Secretary Wingate Lucas, stolen, that the ballot boxes were being stuffed with the votes of mailmen, policemen, and postmen who were not members of the little Congress, and that Johnson was directing the stuffing, was widespread. And so was the belief that if such stuffing did not produce a majority for the Johnson slate, the votes would simply be miscounted by the organization's elected clerk, who was, of course, a Johnson man. "Everybody just knew this," Lucas says. "Everybody said it. They said in that last election that damn Lyndon Johnson stole some votes again." This belief, and his domineering manner, had antagonized many of his fellow secretaries. His popularity among his Washington peers had, in fact, descended to a level little higher than it had been among his San Marcos peers. But his fellow secretaries had never challenged the control of the little Congress by his machine, the cadre of his supporters who accepted his dominance, in part because of fear of incurring his displeasure and thereby losing any chance of advancement in the only organization in which advancement was possible for a secretary. However, among the new secretaries who came to Washington with congressmen elected in November 1934 was a gawky youth, obviously fresh from the country, who arrived in Washington even younger than Johnson had 3 years before, and who possessed his own considerable natural vocation for politics. He was 20-year-old James P. Coleman, a tall, skinny Mississippi farm boy who would shortly begin a whirlwind political career that would propel him to the governorship of Mississippi at the age of 41. Coleman was sufficiently astute to be impressed by Johnson at the first little Congress meeting he attended in January 1935. He was a very tall fellow and had a very commanding personality when he stood up to talk, and he was extremely well informed. He always knew the issues, and, well, he just had something. It sticks out on some folks and not on others. His astuteness, however, allowed him to see through and resent Johnson's attempt to make friends with him by portraying himself in their first conversation as just another country boy. Coleman says he realized quickly that he was one of those highly adaptable fellows. When he was up on the hill, he dressed and acted like he came from the city, but when he met up with someone like myself who had come from a small town in the interior of Mississippi, he acted like a fellow who had grown up with me. Moreover, Coleman, who had decided that he wanted to become an officer of the little Congress, also realized during their first conversation that Johnson would support only those who were willing to knuckle under to him, and he was not one for knuckling under. he decided to run for the speakership at the next election, which would be held in March. Rounding up support for his attempt to defeat Johnson proved unexpectedly easy, particularly among secretaries from Texas. Coleman was warned, however, that support did not necessarily mean victory. He was told about the alleged miscounting of votes, and about the rumors that votes were cast by mailmen and policemen who were not members of the little Congress. He and his three closest allies, Texans Lloyd Crosland, Wingate Lucas, and Gore Hinsley, decided to demand that the votes be counted publicly in front of the entire membership, and that ballots be signed so that each voter's eligibility could be checked. There was hesitancy among Coleman's supporters about insisting on signed ballots because of Johnson's methods toward beaten opponents. As Coleman puts it, "If people who voted against him could be identified, this, of course, gave the winners a chance for revenge on those who voted against them. I remember Crosland and Lucas and Hinsley telling me, 'You better win. We don't want to lose and have Lyndon Johnson's unhappiness about it.'" The March meeting was stormy. Coleman's opponent was William Howard Payne, but Coleman's allies made clear in their speeches in the House caucus room that the chief issue was Payne's chief supporter. "It was really Lyndon we were running against," Lucas says. Pointing to Johnson, who was sitting silently in a corner, Crosland shouted, "That's the man we're going to defeat. He's been bossed too long. We're not going to be bossed." Looking directly at Johnson, he said, "You're not going to tell us what to do." Johnson said nothing. Then Coleman's supporters proposed the new voting procedures. Lucas said, "We're going to have the ballots counted in the open, and we're going to have a membership list and check the ballots against it." Although Johnson again sat silent, his supporters opposed the new rules. Only after a long, angry debate were they adopted. Their adoption meant that the March 1935 meeting of the Little Congress would be the first time that the suspicions which had surrounded elections in which Lyndon Johnson had been involved, elections not only in Washington but at San Marcos, would be given objective scrutiny. The first time the suspicions were checked, the result proved to be precisely what Johnson's opponents had charged it would be. When the signatures on the ballots were checked against the membership list, by two tellers, one from each side, sitting in front of the audience, a number of votes for Payne did, in fact, prove to have been cast by non-members. With these votes included, Johnson's candidate would have won. With these votes thrown out, Johnson's candidate lost. Johnson's reaction to the defeat surprised those who had expected him to attempt a comeback in the next election, although it might not have surprised his boyhood playmates, who had known that if he couldn't lead, he didn't care much about playing. Having lost the leadership of the little Congress, Johnson displayed no further interest in it. The caucus room had been the only place in Washington in which he had possessed prestige and status of his own. Now he was only one of the crowd there, too. Not long thereafter, the old informal voting methods were reinstated, and the checking of votes was abolished. "There was no more need to check," Lucas explains. A later speaker of the little Congress, James F. Swist, who came to the organization in 1939, years after Johnson had left it, expresses surprise that checking had ever been considered necessary. "My God," Swist says, "who would cheat to win the presidency of something like the little Congress?" In his efforts to be somebody, he began frantically, almost desperately, to cast about in wider and wider circles. Welly Hopkins, to whom Johnson appealed for help, says, "He wanted to get ahead. He had that burning ambition. He wanted to climb that ladder. But he didn't know exactly how he was going to climb. Just what order he had in his mind, I don't think he knew any more." Despite previous statements to Hopkins that the real political future lay in national politics and that state government was a dead end, he now asked Welly to get him a state job. In a vague way, he wanted to come back to Texas, and Alvin Wirtz and I talked to Bill McGraw, newly elected state attorney general, and Bill said he didn't know him, but if Wirtz and I wanted him to, he would find a place for him, and Wirtz and I told Lyndon that. But the job actually offered turned out to be at a level that Johnson considered humiliatingly low. In his desperation, he even considered leaving politics. Wirtz, paternally fond of Johnson and impressed by his ability, had offered him a partnership in his Austin law firm if he obtained a law degree, and in September 1934 he had enrolled in evening classes at Georgetown University Law School. At law school, however, his boyhood reluctance, refusal almost, to study, boiled over again. Extremely defensive about his education, "There we go again with that Latin," he would grumble under his breath to Russell Brown, who sat next to him in class. "Why don't they stick to plain English?" He was nonetheless not prepared to make up his deficiencies by studying. Willing to learn specific rules of law, he was unwilling, defiantly, determinedly unwilling, to learn the historical or philosophical reasoning behind them. Johnson's law school career, during which, Brown says, Lyndon never recited once in class, was at any rate ended after 2 months by his marriage. He dropped out of law school to marry Lady Bird, Ellie Jones says. The next job for which Johnson tried was a somewhat surprising choice, considering his lack of interest in formal education. His target was a college presidency. The 1,000 students at the 10-year-old Texas College of Art and Industries, Texas A&I, in Kingsville, wore black blazers decorated with a golden Brahma bull, symbol of the King Ranch, whose funds had helped found the institution. Like most institutions in Clayburg country, it was still dominated by the Claybergs, and Johnson persuaded Dick Clayburg, who had once been chairman of its board of trustees, to support his candidacy. The scholarly Jones, who revered education, was shocked by Johnson's effrontery, not only because of his attitude toward education, but because of his lack of qualifications. All he had was a B.A. degree, and Jones was horrified when Johnson confided to him that he thought he was going to get the job. There was a period of several weeks when he dreamed, talked about what he would do as president, talked it all out, how he would revolutionize the college, slant it towards agriculture, make it the greatest college in the United States. In the event, however, cooler heads intervened, and Jones's fears and Johnson's hopes turned out to be unfounded. Then a new path opened. Johnson, who so admired Roy Miller and Miller's fellow big-time lobbyists as real operators, had often said, "I want to be a big lobbyist like Roy Miller." Now he got the chance. Miller's buddy, the reactionary General Electric string puller, Horatio H. Rash Adams, paternally fond of Johnson and impressed by his entree into government departments, formally offered him a job at $10,000 per year, a congressman's salary, as his assistant, the number two lobbying job in Washington for giant GE. But with the chance actually before him, Johnson hesitated. According to those with whom he discussed Adams's offer, his reason for hesitating was not principle, but rather a consideration emphasized by Roy Miller. Speaking in terms of the Texas of that era, times would later change in Texas, Miller told Johnson, in several long, serious talks, that acceptance of the General Electric post might mean the end forever of Johnson's hopes for elective office, and for a career in the public side of politics. The man identified as a corporate lobbyist, Miller said bluntly, could never win a major office in Texas. The offer was nonetheless a heady one for a 26-year-old secretary, then earning an annual salary of $3,000. Accepting it would give him not only a salary equal to that of a congressman, but entree that might well be superior. Lyndon had stars in his eyes at the offer, Jones says. He was impressed. These lobbyists had the run of the Capitol, you know. For 2 or 3 weeks he was speculating how nice it would be to be a big dog like this. More important, if the path opened to him by Adams was not the path of which Lyndon Johnson had dreamed, it seemed, during these anxious months of 1935, to be the only path open to him. All through his life, an indication of a crisis in Johnson's career would be a breakdown in his physical health. His first serious illness, the pneumonia that sent him to the hospital, occurred during these months. He was desperate to be somebody, and this job would make him somebody. Though accepting it would force him to leave, possibly forever, the field of politics, which was his natural vocation. He was, aides and friends agree, on the verge of accepting it. But, as it turned out, he would not have to. His talent at arousing paternal affection in powerful older men would, at the last minute, provide him with opportunity within his chosen field. The General Electric job was offered in May or June of 1935. On June 26, 1935, with Johnson about to accept the offer, President Roosevelt announced the creation of a new governmental agency. It would be called the National Youth Administration. Its annual budget would be $50 million, and it would be administered in each state by a state director. Texas Senator Tom Connally would have an important voice in the selection of the Texas NYA director. Sam Rayburn went to see him. Connally was surprised by the visit. He and Rayburn had never been friends. He was surprised by the purpose of the visit, for he knew, as everyone on Capitol Hill knew, that Rayburn never asked even a friend for a favor. And he was surprised by Rayburn's demeanor, by the face of this man who never let his feelings show. For feelings were showing now. One day Sam Rayburn, who had never been friendly toward me, came to see me, Connally was to recall. He wanted me to ask President Roosevelt to appoint Lyndon Johnson. Sam was agitated. He was, in fact, so agitated that he refused to leave Connally's office until, Connally says, I agreed to do this. Connally agreed, but the White House refused to accept his recommendation. It reacted with amusement to the very thought of entrusting a statewide program to a 26-year-old utterly without administrative experience. It announced that the Texas NYA director would be DeWitt Kennard, a former union official from Port Arthur. Kennard was, in fact, formally sworn in to the post. Sam Rayburn went to the White House. What he said is not known, but the White House announced that a mistake had been made. The NYA director for Texas was not DeWitt Kennard, after all, the announcement said. It was Lyndon B. Johnson. The appointment made Johnson the youngest of the 48 state directors of the NYA. He may, in fact, have been the youngest person to be given statewide authority for any major New Deal program. Was he pleased? Was his ambition satisfied, even for a moment? When his appointment was announced, other secretaries crowded into his office to congratulate him. What was his response? "When I come back to Washington," he said, "I'm coming back as a congressman." Chapter 19. Put Them to Work. The National Youth Administration was the inspiration not of Franklin Roosevelt, but of his wife, who said in May 1934, "I have moments of real terror when I think we may be losing this generation." "Lost generation" was a phrase occurring with increasing frequency in discussions of America's youth. Attendance at the nation's colleges had begun falling in 1931, with more and more parents unable to afford tuition, and with students having a steadily more difficult time obtaining part-time jobs to help pay their way. High school attendance had begun falling in 1932 because steadily increasing numbers of teenagers had to drop out and go to work to help support their families, often at a dime an hour, the prevailing depression wage for teenage workers. Or because their families couldn't spare them even the money necessary for books or pencils or bus fare or shoes. Again and again in many states, wrote the historians of the NYA, Betty and Ernest K. Lindley, we heard the word shoes used as the equation for going to school. The children can get to school until it's snow time. They can't go then unless they have shoes. Underwear can be made from sugar sacks. Clothes can be patched and remade. Shoes seem the insurmountable obstacle to school attendance. While no attempt to collect statistics on the young was comprehensive, every attempt was instructive, as if, as the Lindleys put it, the attempts sank scalpels far enough into the social organism to expose to view conditions far worse than most people had suspected. The United States had always been proud of its educational system. Now, in 1935, with the Depression in its sixth year, a study, one which did not include the Deep South, where educational levels were traditionally low, would disclose that of 35,000 young people employed in NYA work projects, half had never gone to school a day beyond the eighth grade. Out of every 100 such young people, then, only 50 reached high school. Out of that 50, only 10 graduated from high school. Out of that 10, only 3 even began college. And out of those 3, fewer than 2 graduated from college. 2 out of 100. As the Lindleys wrote, "The more one sees, the more insistent becomes the question, where is the celebrated American school system?" Once out of school, young people found themselves looking for jobs in a world with few jobs to offer. In normal times, some would have been taken on as beginners or apprentices, earning enough to live on while they learned a trade. Now, with even skilled men pounding the pavements, who was hiring apprentices? Of the 22 million persons between the ages of 16 and 25 in the United States in 1935, at least 3.3 million, and perhaps as many as 5 million, were both out of school and out of work, millions of young people drifting through their days with nothing constructive to do. For such youths, idle, bereft of hope, even coming home at night was agony. Said one, "Maybe you don't know what it's like to come home and have everyone looking at you, and you know what they're thinking, even if they don't say it. He didn't find a job. It gets terrible. You just don't want to come home." Many of them, more and more of them in one of the Depression's most disturbing developments, didn't come home. A government investigator watching ragged, bundle-clutching figures jumping off a Southern Pacific freight train as it pulled into the yards in El Paso was shocked to see that most of them are only boys, but the railroad bull standing beside him told him his surprise was unwarranted. "Most of those on the road nowadays are young men," he said, "just young fellows, just boys who don't know where they're going or why." Many of them were heading west. Poignantly, some of them compared themselves with their forefathers, who had headed in the same direction. But, as the Lindleys wrote, "The last frontier disappeared some 40 years ago. When young men now want to move on, they find there is no place to go." The hospitable Western howdy had been replaced by the "keep moving" of law enforcement officials who escorted newcomers to the nearest county line. And when they got as far west as they could, to Golden, California, they found guards posted on the highway to turn them back at the border, and those of them who made it into the state anyway were placed in forced labor camps until they could be dumped back over the state line. The youths lived in squalid hobo jungles with thieves, alcoholics, drug addicts, and ex-convicts, and the railroad bull in El Paso told the federal man, "The worst thing is that the boys may turn into bums. This year already they are tougher than they were last year." Observers with a broader overview held the same opinion. To workers in the U.S. Children's Bureau and the National Association of Travelers' Aid Societies, William Manchester was to report, it sometimes seemed that the youth of a nation was being destroyed on the rails. While the New Deal might be making headway in other areas, it was losing ground on the youth front. Every year, either by graduating or dropping out, some 2.25 million more young people were leaving schools and colleges. And every year the number of young people both out of school and out of work rose. And even more ominously, by 1935 a substantial number had been in that category for a long time. The Depression was in its 6th year now, and as one 1935 study put it, boys and girls who were 15 or 16 in 1929 when the Depression began are no longer children, they are grown-ups. Adults who had never, since they left school, had anything productive to do. Adults embittered by years of suffering and hardship. The President's Advisory Commission on Education was to warn of a whole lost generation of young people. In thinking of the youth problem, moreover, September always loomed ahead. September when schools opened, and America's children either entered their doors or didn't. In September 1934, no fewer than 700,000 boys and girls of high school age had failed to enroll in high school. Now the September of 1935 was approaching, and unless something was done, that number would be even higher. Hundreds of thousands more young people would join the ranks of that lost generation. Eleanor Roosevelt, whose empathy with the young, with those who would rather light the candles than curse, was always so deep, had sat on platforms, many platforms, where lecturers told young people that their problems were their own fault, and she had not agreed. After one conference at which former Secretary of War Newton D. Baker said there was plenty of opportunity for young people of initiative and spirit to earn a living, she wrote him, "I confess that my own imagination has been extremely lacking for the last few months. If you have any convincing suggestions, I shall be more than grateful." Baker had no such suggestions. The plight of youth, Mrs. Roosevelt felt, was the fault of society. "A civilization which does not provide young people with a way to earn a living is pretty poor," she said. Having grasped the dimensions of the problem early, it had been in May 1934 that she spoke of her real terror about it. She had early begun pressing her husband to alleviate it with some program which would help youngsters stay in school and out of the ranks of the unemployed, and which would also give youngsters out of school both jobs and the training for better jobs. Nor was this all she wanted for them. "We have got to make these young people feel that they are necessary," she said. And she said they should be given certain things for which youth craves, the chance for self-sacrifice for an ideal. What she envisioned was some sort of youth service for the country on a broader scale, and incorporating more formal education and vocational training than the immensely popular Civilian Conservation Corps, which had been created during the Hundred Days. Her husband, whose inventor's pride in the CCC, which was largely his personal inspiration, perhaps made him reluctant to concede the need for additional measures, and who saw that a program such as the one his wife was suggesting would be bitterly opposed, not only because the education lobby would fear that federal intervention in education would lessen its control of the schools, but because of traditional fears that such a program would inject politics into the schools, did not at once agree. Fulton Orsler witnessed one discussion between them on the subject, a discussion that became rather heated when Eleanor called the CCC too militaristic. Franklin, "It's the last thing in the world, it really is." Eleanor, "Well, after all, my dear, it is under the supervision of the army." Franklin, "That does not make it militaristic." The president made the additional point that there was no specific young people's problem, but only a problem of the whole people. Another delegation could come to you representing men over 40 who can't get jobs. Such movements as a youth movement seem to be especially unnecessary. But Mrs. Roosevelt knew how to appeal to her husband. She shifted, Joseph P. Lash relates, to the political argument. The young people would soon be voters. Franklin relaxed. "There is a great deal to what you say." Her husband was a practical politician, she later said. If other arguments failed, he was always sensitive to the purely political argument. Then some of his advisers, even Harry Hopkins and Aubrey Williams, warned him that the establishment of a youth agency in the government might boomerang politically by raising the cry that he was trying to regiment America's youth the way Germany was doing. "If it is the right thing to do for the young people, then it should be done," he replied. "I guess we can stand the criticism, and I doubt if our youth can be regimented in this or any other way." That was another side of him, Lash has written. He was not only the politician. "I have determined that we shall do something for the nation's unemployed youth," he declared. "They must have their chance." The National Youth Administration was created to give it to them. Since to defuse the regimentation charge, it had been decided that the NYA should operate with a minimum of centralized control. Each of the 48 state directors was to be allowed the widest latitude to create, organize, and administer his own program. Even during the period of the NYA's greatest activity, when it was employing 500,000 youths, its national office in Washington would never grow to more than 67 persons, including secretaries. The Texas state director's initial creation was a staff. In assembling it, Lyndon Johnson's ability to read men was put to the proof, and was proven. The men he wanted were the men he had cashed in patronage jobs while he had been Dick Clayburgh's secretary. In selecting them to be the recipients of his patronage, he had been gambling that when at some future date he called them, they would come to him. Now he called, And they came, even those who did not want to. Not a year before, Willard Deason, bowing to Johnson's arguments, had forsaken a promising career in education for a career in law. Now Deason was summoned for another chat. No more was heard about the beauties of the law. Flying to Austin on July 27, 1935, the day after his appointment was announced, Johnson, meeting with Deason, dwelt instead on the beauties of the National Youth Administration. "I had never heard of it," Deason recalls, and his eagerness to join it was not enhanced by the meager salary, $2,100, he was offered. But Johnson, he says, was the greatest salesman. The marching orders had been changed, and Deason obeyed them. Feeling that his job as attorney with the Federal Land Bank was a real stepping stone, he agreed at the July 27th meeting to leave it only for 2 weeks. When Johnson pleaded with him to help me get this thing started, he said he would use his two-week vacation to do so. But during those 2 weeks, Johnson persuaded him to take a six-month leave of absence from the land bank job. And at the end of the 6 months, Deason left it permanently. His reluctance was matched by Jesse Kellum's. Kellum, the tough ex-fullback who had been given the State Education Department position that had been the best job at Johnson's disposal, had been promoted to the department's fourth-ranking post, a high-paying, prestigious, secure position as State Director of Rural Aid. And with his memories of his terrible years in Lufkin still vivid, he had no intention of leaving it. But Johnson persuaded him to take a 2-week leave of absence, and at the end of those 2 weeks, he persuaded him to take another 2. And at the end of that period, Kellum left his state job for one that paid less than half as much. Similar scenes were repeated a dozen times, always with success. Even Ben Crider, hardly installed in the federal post that was the best job I ever had, left it. Lyndon Johnson's appointment had allowed him to bring together in a single office the men he had scattered through the federal bureaucracy. To the nucleus of a staff thus formed, Johnson added new recruits whose personalities documented yet again the fact that what Johnson called loyalty, unquestioning obedience, not only willingness but eagerness to take orders, to bow to his will, was the quality he most desired in subordinates. Many of the men he hired now were former White Stars from San Marcos. They were not the brightest of that band of brothers, but rather those who, like Wilton Woods, had demonstrated at college a capacity for subservience. Men who had been leaders of the secret fraternity, and who had revealed a capacity for success in the postgraduate world, were not hired. One of the bright White Stars, Horace Richards, had been given a job while Johnson was Clayburgh's secretary, but had insisted on offering and arguing for his own opinions. He was not given an NYA job. The personalities of the new non-San Marcos recruits documented the same point. The one young man from the hill country, besides the malleable Crider to be hired, had, as a boy, demonstrated the greatest willingness to allow young Lyndon Johnson to assume the place he wanted, the forefront, the head of the ring. Sherman Birdwell of Buda had, as a boy, not only followed Lyndon Johnson around obediently while their parents were visiting together, but had even attempted to imitate his way of talking and walking, and who, indeed, continued as a man to do so. Creating a staff proved easier than creating a program. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.